for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Using science to debunk myths, from the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Sky Dragon Slaying. And a subject close to our heart is global warming, man-made global warming. Is it real or not? We've been doing this thing at Principia Scientific International for over 12 years, me and Joe Olson. And Joe Posma, space scientist in Canada, you've been doing it nearly as long yourself. With us today is Tom Nelson, a well-known skeptic with a master's degree in electrical and electronic engineering, another one of those scientists who works from applied science and can criticize the so-called academic approach where they use computer models to make all sorts of claims. Back in 2005, Tom Nelson was an avid birdwatcher. He became heavily involved in debunking a high-profile but bogus ivory-billed woodpecker rediscovery. And that actually opened his eyes up to the problems of so-called peer-reviewed science. And, you know, he then became quite avidly skeptical because the climate change debate is full of people appealing to authority. Peer-reviewed science is, you know, in the spotlight again. It's being criticized as not being credible. We've had it in our first hour with Elizabeth Hart. The fact that there's a cover-up, there's a kind of a power review thing going on, and it's you know, the authorities, the experts, they've got vested interests. They're out for their own ends. And Tom Nelson, welcome to the show. Glad to have you.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Just give us a little bit of background on this ivory-billed woodpecker thing. I mean, why did that spark you off the way it did?
It's just very interesting to me because I was an avid birdwatcher at the time, and it was just such a mind-blowing rediscovery that the ivory-billed woodpecker is one of the most sought-after birds, and they thought it had been extinct for many decades. And all of a sudden in 2005, it was grandly announced that they had rediscovered it, and people got so excited about it that they pulled off the side of the road when they heard this on NPR, and they wept with joy. But it turns out it was completely bogus, that it was a misidentification and there was no ivory bill, even though there was a peer-reviewed paper with 17 authors saying, yep, we rediscovered it. But I checked into it, and the evidence was just amazingly flimsy. And it astonished me that they could write a peer-reviewed paper and get it published based on pretty much nothing.
Yeah, I think one of the points of evidence you cited, I think, was a pixelated photograph with, I think, only about 5 or 6 pixels actually confirming it.
Yeah, it was 6 pixels. It was a set of a 3x2 matrix of pixels with like 4 blacks and 2 whites. And that was supposed to be, people believed that was a photograph of an ivory-billed woodpecker. Pretty amazing. But I pointed out that you could take a picture right now in anybody's office and you could easily find 6 pixel ivory bills. If you zoomed in enough, you can find black and white matrices. And it was just amazing that was considered evidence that they had rediscovered it. So anyway, that really got me involved in checking out the evidence of a lot of other things.
Yeah, we like joining the dots here on Sky Dragon Slaying. We like to join the dots of fake science. And Joe Olson, you're terrific at this. And, you know, we've seen it in the COVID pandemic. We've seen it, the PCR tests. You know, just to join us, a bit of a comparison, the PCR test was invented by Professor Kerry Mullis, and he said his test was never meant to be used as a diagnostic tool. And the analogy used in his test is that if you keep making a photocopy of a photocopy, you end up with gray mess. And he said that was pretty much what they were doing with the cycling of the 35 plus cycles of the PCR test. It's a very similar point, isn't it, where academia, they go to the point, they go to extreme lengths to validate their claims. And it's Joe Olson, do you want to jump in there and add a few points?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm very much into birds myself. I'm not an official bird watcher, but when I was a kid, there was a pileated woodpecker, which I had never seen one before, fell out of a tree. And we caught it and thought, man, this is really incredible. Called the Houston Zoo and they said, oh, just leave it back on the ground. I said, well, a cat or a dog's going to eat it. They go, well, that's what nature wants. And it's like, well, we're bringing it to the zoo and you can take care of it. So we went ahead and took it to the zoo, but it's a close relative of the ivory bill. And so if you had a photo of a pileated and you pixelized it a little bit, the only real difference is the bark and a little bit of other undertones. But yeah, incredible that they think they can get away with lying about absolutely everything. And so as long as it brings in more grant money, they don't really care. It's pretty sad.
Yeah, yeah. Tom, you've done quite well because you had a debate, and I like watching a video, YouTube video of you debating an alarmist. You do very well, don't you? When it's live and it's unscripted, we don't get that opportunity, do we? Our side of the argument, we don't get the chance to have a public debate. Can you tell us a little bit how that went for you?
It was fun for me. I have invited a lot of people on my podcast to debate climate change. I really enjoy doing that, but I've only had one taker so far. So I had debated last month or maybe 6 weeks ago, and I quickly found out that my opponent, Gerald Kootenay, really hadn't looked into the evidence much for himself. And I think that's really the problem with most people on the climate cult side, is that they're so sure that they're right that they haven't looked into the evidence. And skeptics, everybody's fighting us. We've looked into the evidence, and I've been down every rabbit hole. So I was able to talk to him about sea level rise and crop yield and hurricanes and just all sorts of things that he hadn't really looked at the data. He just assumed that hurricanes are getting worse. He just assumed that CO2 is bad for crop yields, and on and on. So it was just fun for me to go through those things kind of one at a time. And that's the way my mind works. I like to just look at one thing at a time. Like, let's just look at crop yields and what is the real data. And you can, if you look at historical data that anybody can look up on the internet, you can see that crop yields have done just great since 1960. So even though we've emitted a lot of CO2, evidently CO2 is not able to suppress crop yields. And obviously it actually is good for crop yields. But it's just amazing that people in 2022 honestly believe that crop yields are going down, or we're facing starvation because of climate change, because there's no evidence at all to back that up.
Yeah, yeah. And the way it's been shaping up, there are issues with food distribution. There are issues with the fact that points of origin, for example, let's talk about the Dutch for a short while. The idea of suppressing Dutch farmers from growing crops, it kind of plays into the narrative, doesn't it? Because if you're not really savvy with what's really going on with CO2, you get to the conclusion that it actually is a pollutant. When in fact, we've demonstrated time and time on our show that actually CO2 is plant fertilizer. And even NASA's agreed that the rise in CO2 over the past 40 years has led to a greening of the Sahara Desert, up to about 15% increase in greening on the Sahara itself. So, you know, there's a lot of facts out there on our side, aren't there? And it's all very inconvenient for the alarmists, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, all the facts are on our side. Will Happer was just on my podcast, and he was saying that I believe that the increase in global wheat yield since 1960 or so, maybe up to 30% of that increase may be due just to the additional CO2 in the air. Now, there's all sorts of other reasons why crop yields have gone up, but it is a big deal that CO2 has gone up from 280 to 420 in terms of the plant food portion of it. So CO2 is great plant food, but it's not the climate control knob. So science is totally on our side.
Yeah, Joe Olson, you like to point out that in Principia Scientific, we have our friend Dr. Pierre Latour. What does Pierre Latour say about that? He's a world expert in carbon dioxide. Can you come in, Joe, on that point?
Yes. Dr. Pierre Latour has a PhD in chemical engineering. He was a U.S. Army captain in charge of the Apollo mission, so he's a bona fide rocket scientist. He owns 12 patents on chemical refining processes where carbon dioxide is not only a reactant, but it's also a byproduct. And you have to know how it behaves thermally and chemically in order to be able to properly design and control chemical plants. So he's very knowledgeable about that. He was former president of Principia Scientific. And while he was there, he wrote an article called Four Known Ways Carbon Dioxide Cools Earth's Climate. As a footnote, he includes that it uses the photosynthesis, and he includes the chemical formula for photosynthesis, which definitely does cool the earth. But this is actually a three-sided argument, and it's not just the warmest, who I labeled that back in 2010, and it's not the lukewarmest, which I also labeled as lukewarmest in 2010, but it's the no warmest. And we are of the firm no warmest camp, and I would like to have you debate me someday about the viability of even a little about of carbon warming, because it's virtually physically impossible.
Yeah, it's great when we've got somebody on the show who's very much into open debate. And Tom, you know, we take our hats off to you for getting an alarmist actually out there to debate with you live. And it's something we really want to see more of. What's your view then on the actual role of CO2? Do you see it as being partly responsible or play no role at all?
I do not know the physics at the lowest level, so I'm not willing to go with the zero effect on climate, but I'm open to the idea that that's right. But I have heard people like Richard Lindzen and Will Happer say that the effect, there's a small effect. And to me, it doesn't make much difference whether the CO2 effect is small or if it's zero. I don't think it makes much difference either way. If there is a small warming effect of CO2, then I firmly believe that's beneficial. And so the warming since 1850 has been beneficial. And if CO2 has caused part of that, I think it has been good for life on Earth.
Yeah. It's a fair point to make that because throughout history, we've seen that warming periods are synonymous with greater growth and cooling periods are synonymous with a scaling back of wildlife. And we can see it right now today. If you go to the polar regions, you can see where it's extremely cold. There's a dearth of life. But you go to the tropics where it's very, very warm, you can see life is very, very abundant. And it's something that it's very evident. And a lot of people, they don't seem to grasp the fact that, if a colder planet is not good, is it? Not good for life.
No, it definitely isn't. And there's a reason why the people in Canada, they're clustered in the southern part of Canada. Humans like warm weather and it's just too cold in northern Canada. And we are still in an ice age right now. So if the Earth was to warm by 2 or 3 degrees centigrade, even that much, I think that would just be fine. And that would be actually better than the current temperature. So this whole idea that 3 degrees centigrade is going to kill us all is just a non-starter. It does not make any sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of nonsense. There's a lot of straw man arguments put out by the alarmists where they say the temperature is too high. And then we counter that by saying, well, what is the correct temperature? What should the temperature of Earth be? And it's a quandary, isn't it? So, would you say there was an optimum temperature? Was there any time in history, do you think, that we should look at the golden age of life on Earth?
I don't think while humans have been on Earth, I think the Earth has never been too hot for humans. In the past, they called these warm periods that we've been through, they called those optimums. So I think the Roman warm period, the Minoan warm period, I think the peaks of those warm periods were great times to be alive on Earth. That's when they were building big cathedrals and the crops were there were good crop yields and people were healthy. Somebody was saying that you can look at the old skeletons and you could see that people were doing pretty well back when it was warm. And then even relatively recently in the Little Ice Age, that was not a good time to be alive. That's when crop yields were low and there was starvation and disease and life was not good when it was cold, even in maybe the year, let's see, late 1700s or so. So anyway, warmth is good for us. We're a tropical species.
Very good point. Joe Olson, have you got your little anecdotes there for the climate argument?
Yeah, it does really matter whether it warms a little or a lot because it's just one of multiple supposedly warming gases in the atmosphere, which includes water vapor, which absorbs in 37,000 spectral lines, methane, which absorbs in 3 spectral lines. We'll go into that in a little bit more detail. And now they're claiming nitrous oxide, which is 0.33 parts per million, but that's what we use for fertilizer. So that's got to be hit on the climate hit list too. And if you look at the actual radiation transmitted by the atmosphere chart, which is available on Google, you can go to Google Images and pull it up. It shows the actual total absorption, then the absorption by water vapor, carbon dioxide, oxygen, ozone, methane, and nitrous oxide. And bottom line is 30% of the incoming energy from the sun never makes it to the surface of the Earth. And the amount that's radiated off the Earth does not cause any warming by anything that's absorbed in the atmosphere. Any absorption is followed immediately by what's called a Stokes shift reduction in frequency and energy level. Mm.
Good point. Tom Nelson, when you talk about your writing on the issue of climate change, do you find like us that we tend to look at authorities and we kind of pinpoint those we refer to? Joe Olson referred to Dr. Pierre Latour, an applied scientist. Do you find that you tend to refer more to academics or applied scientists? Being an applied scientist yourself, do you find that credible?
Yeah, I definitely like to look at the empirical side rather than the theoretical side. So I do place a lot more weight on things that are actually happening in the real world rather than theoretical things, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, I mean, I'm a great believer in using empirical science and validation. We say in Principia Scientific, the scientific method is there for a reason. If you can't replicate, if it can't be tested and the hypothesis has to be tested to destruction effectively. And the advocates of the global warming, they don't like to test their hypothesis. It seems to be like an anathema to them. And the computer models are rigged, aren't they? It's a question of secret science. We never know the coding, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. I just wanted to go back actually and just make a point about the nitrous oxide and how they're trying to cut out farming in the Netherlands because of that. I do think that they are going to do stuff to kind of sabotage farmers, and then they are going to blame that on climate change. I think if there is any starvation, they're going to say, hey, look at climate change caused this. I'm afraid that that's going to be a mainstream narrative. I hope it isn't, but it looks like they're setting that up.
Yeah, we tend to agree with you on that one, Tom. And what we'll do is we'll visit that after the break. It's TNT okay. Radio.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
It doesn't really matter who you bank with. The axe is being wielded for bank branches. Less people are going in. I believe there should be a presence of banks there because there's a lot of old folk. They don't want online banking. They don't want to speak to a call center in Timbuktu. They want to go in their local branch with their little book and talk to a human being and get their cash out. And why the hell not? They've supported you stinking, rotten corporate dogs for decades of their lives. So give them a break. Now they're in the twilight of their lives. Don't humiliate them. Don't threaten them with bank apps or they can't bank. And don't tell them to go outside in the rain and use the ATM. For crying out loud, show some respect for your elders. It's one of the reasons why our society's in the position it's in now. We don't respect our elders.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
So, you support green energy? Ask yourself this. How many native birds were killed by wind turbines today? Protect humanity and stop the green madness. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hi, welcome back on the show, Tom Nelson, an applied scientist with a master's degree. We're talking about climate change, the so-called narrative of man-made catastrophic global warming. We don't see it. We don't see it beyond the computer models of academics. And academics are usually funded by governments, and they're very well paid to do what they do. And let's face it, people love a crisis. They like to talk about crises. And we're over here on our side of it. We can't see any crisis, can we, gentlemen? And Joe Posma, you're up in Canada. We said how cold it is up there. How bad is it for you?
Well, yeah, we're having the normal temperature. So we had a lovely October, but today we got hit with 8 inches of snow. Tom, it's very nice to meet you. I haven't enjoyed watching some of your videos. I really did enjoy that debate you had with Gerald Kootenay. It was clear that he was actually clueless. He had no clue about any of the science fundamentals whatsoever. He tried just sort of parroting off a few basic narrative points, but you really had him. I enjoyed the way that you constantly challenged him as denying various facts about the climate, which actually don't support the alarmist narrative. You're really good at that. I was wondering, is that your natural technique, or did you have that planned? Have you had much luck with that sort of a challenging technique?
No, I didn't have any of it planned. Maybe I should have, but it's just maybe it comes from on Twitter. I've had a lot of debates on Twitter, so maybe kind of transferred some of that into a speech or something. Yeah.
Yeah, that's excellent. So I did see the title of one of your videos, so I'm going to ask you this right now. So why do you think that people should be a skeptic of alarming anthropogenic climate change? How would you summarize that?
Yeah, I think that just as an ordinary person, you don't have to be a climate scientist at all. All you have to do is just have an open mind and just check the claims for yourself. That's I've done that for basically 15 years. When they say, for example, crop yields are going down, or you can just check that for yourself, or you can check the hurricane data, and you can check the heat wave data. You can do all sorts of checking to see what's happened in the real world. And a lot of this idea is that the climate crisis is here and everything's worse than it used to be, but you can very easily check that for yourself if you just have confidence in yourself to look at the data. And it's not rocket science to look at the data.
Yeah, that's the thing. It does require looking at the data, and probably most people are too intimidated to do that. Typically, the applied scientists such as yourself, and Tony Heller is also a really wonderful example of a person who simply goes and looks at the data and says, this is what the data actually shows, and it's actually completely the opposite. Typically engineers are very good at something like that and very comfortable with it. It's probably typically why we find the most support from engineers and applied scientists rather than the pure academics who seem to simply enjoy repeating the narrative for some reason.
Yeah, so I do like to say that we have been emitting CO2 for maybe a couple hundred years now. So if all this bad stuff that's going to happen, we've run the experiment, we should be able to tell if it's making the weather worse or anything else, and it's just not. There's nothing wrong with the weather. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's such a great point. No, it is such a good point. And you made a point earlier about how you look at one thing at a time, right? And I'd like to see how you do that. You do look at one thing at a time. But the thing is, if you look at one thing at a time a whole bunch of times, you eventually build up a panorama. And the panorama we all arrive at is that this whole thing is junk science, right? So in one of your first videos on your channel, it's just dated June 16, 2020, you said catastrophic anthropogenic global warming is the most massive scientific fraud in human history. So I'd love you to just explain to us, how that's a very bold, powerful statement. But just before I let you get there, I do have a book by that title. It's actually titled The Layman's Guide to the Greatest Scientific Fraud in History. So the question that I always have is why? How could this entire endeavor of climate science and all these points, like you said, one point at a time, but eventually you build up a whole panorama. So how can all of these points get it wrong so badly, so consistently, and so often? So in my mind, looking at it systematically, there has to be a systemic problem. There has to be a systemic underlying problem so that no matter where this supposed climate science touches, it gets it wrong. It inverts it. There has to be an underlying systemic problem to get that result so consistently. And so in our findings with PSI, that problem is this greenhouse effect idea that the colder atmosphere, generally the atmosphere is colder than the surface, right? Unless you have an inversion, but that's a very special case. But right. I mean, in terms of the physics of heat flow, you cannot have return heat from the colder atmosphere. The atmosphere is cooling, it's cooling by convection. So while it's cooling, it cannot also be heating. It's only doing one or the other, right? So it's generally cooling. This greenhouse effect idea that they have in climate science, which is not how a real greenhouse functions, it's an alternative thing that they just use the same name. Anyway, the basic postulate is that heat has to come back from the atmosphere and warm up at the surface some more. And so the thermodynamics of that is it's junk science. It doesn't work. And it seems to be that's what the systemic error is. That's where it starts. So I get into the book and I just describe just how big of a fraud this is scientifically. But let's have your opinion. So how did you arrive at the idea that it was the most massive scientific fraud in human history?
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while. No one has been able to provide a bigger one. I think at least until 2 years ago, another one of the biggest ones was Lysenkoism. I think a lot of people starved because of that. There's this whole idea that if you kept seeds cold, I think you're going to get better crop yields in Russia. A lot of people ended up dying because of that one. But this one is so big in terms of the number of dollars that's been spent and all the changes that they're making in terms of getting rid of reliable energy and everything. And all the people that believe in it. It just, I have not been able to find anything that's more massive than this one. And what I think is the biggest underlying problem as to why this has gone on so long is I think it would be groupthink. I think there's just so much groupthink involved here. Now, I can see this on Twitter all the time, even when I'm talking to climate scientists. I can see that they haven't looked into it for themselves. They're just, it's faith-based science. And they've trusted that somebody else has proved that there's a climate crisis. So then they can go on and they can look at the effect of the alleged climate crisis on whatever they're interested in. But I think groupthink is the number one problem.
Yeah, it does seem to be that. And it's kind of disturbing to me just how pervasive and how easy it is for just, your general scientists to fall into that pattern. You know, I work in astrophysics and I find it very difficult to simply have really basic discussions, as you do and as Tony Heller does. You know, it's not difficult. I mean, for goodness sake, an astrophysicist can read a graph, right? We know
yes.
Our life is, a scientist's life is graphs. You know what I mean? We know graphs. All you have to do is look at a few graphs and you get the answer. Like I looked at like two graphs and when I first got into this and it was, that was enough for me. Two graphs was enough. You know what I mean? So it's just strange. It's just strange that I find it so difficult to get them to engage. What I find is that they just refuse to now. That's almost like they're afraid to now. I get the sense. Do you get that sense?
I do get that sense. But again, it's so easy to check the data. Like one example here is heat waves in Minnesota. Like it was so much hotter here in the summer in the 1930s and 40s than it is now. And you can just you can look it up in 30 seconds yourself. You can see that in the 30s and 40s here, it hit 100 degrees 38 times. And since 2012, it's hit it two times. It just is not hitting 100 degrees nearly as much now as it did then. And people like to say, oh, that's just one place, but it's the same everywhere. Tony Heller has done a great job of looking at those that old data, old newspaper headlines, et cetera. And you can just see that this whole idea that it's way hotter now is just not true.
Yeah, exactly. If you want to skip back to the intro to getting to know you, what was your exact transition then into the climate issue then from, we were mentioning the bird watching thing and this hoax with this woodpecker coming back. So where was the path from there to climate for you?
That's a fun question because there was an exact moment when it happened because I was involved heavily into this Ivory Bill thing. And then this guy who was a meteorologist said, I've been following both your Ivory Bill debate and I've been following the global warming debate. And he said, there's all sorts of parallels between these two things. So he wrote me, it's a couple page email. It was very well done showing the parallels between the two controversies. So as soon as I read that email, I thought, okay, maybe this global warming thing is not all it's cracked up to be. So before that, I was a casual believer that the earth was too hot, et cetera. I didn't march for climate or anything, but I still had some belief that scientists would get it right. So I kind of believed it. But when I read that email and he made so many good points about how there's this faith in experts. And if you actually look at the data yourself, you can see that it's all a crock. So anyway, that was around 2005 or 2006 is when I jumped into the global warming debate. And I've been pretty much involved in it daily ever since then.
Excellent. Yeah, that's an excellent phrase, a casual believer. Yeah, that's what I would have been as well. Probably all of us were until the moment where you actually go and look at a graph. I think the simple fact of the matter is that these most mainstream scientists simply refuse to do that for some reason. But you made a good point earlier about the experiment having been run. We've went from, what was it, 290, right? Was the pre-industrial concentration 290
280 290 yeah
right yeah of carbon dioxide yep. Now we're over 400, so yeah, you're right, the experiment has been run. It's the concentration of carbon dioxide has gone up quite a bit and there really hasn't been that much change in temperature. There's no signal. I think you had Willie Soon on a few weeks ago and I think he said the CO2 stuff is pure delusion. You cannot find any signature of that. What did he mean when he said you cannot find any signature of CO2?
Yeah, I think he may have been going back even further. Like you mentioned, just since we went from 280 to 420, temperature has not cracked, has not tracked that increase. But if you go back 600 million years even, and if you look at the estimates of CO2 and of temperature going back that far, there's pretty much no correlation between CO2, at least no causal correlation between CO2 and temperature. So we had ice ages when there was enormous amounts of CO2 and the other way too. So there's no evidence at all that that CO2 is the climate control knob, even going back 600 million years.
Yeah, well, that's such a great point, looking at experimental empirical data and looking at the results. So, I mean, just in ending, I'll just make the point that, you know, as far as experimental science goes, if there's supposed to be a greenhouse effect, and if CO2 is supposed to be the main thing that causes it, and what is it? I mean, the physics of it has to work if it's true. It has to cause warming. You can't have a greenhouse effect and increase CO2 and not have warming. That's impossible. The physics of it is that it has to warm. So if we run the experiment and you look at the historical data, there's no correlation and there's no warming. Well, what does that say then about the basic theory of the greenhouse effect? Just empirically, you have to accept the result. The experiment has been run. There's no signal there.
Yeah, well, carry on, Tom. Okay.
I do have a question. This is kind of a layman's greenhouse effect question. Do you agree that if there was no atmosphere, that the Earth would be 33 degrees Celsius colder? I think I just read that. Do you agree with that part of it or no?
Well, that becomes very complicated because, if you look at the surface of the moon, you have the exposed part can get up to 120 degrees Celsius, 121, because that's the actual flux of sunlight. The dark side, obviously drops. When you have an atmosphere, you have additional thermal mass, which circulates, and so it distributes that heat very efficiently. You also have the adiabatic gradient in the atmosphere, where the bottom of the atmosphere has to be warmer than the top. But basically, the temperature of the air has to decrease. It's an adiabatic gradient. It's a very easy thing to derive in physics. It's just a conservation of energy equation. Very easy to derive that the temperature at the bottom of the atmosphere, the gas at the bottom of the atmosphere has to be warmest and then it cools going up. So then the question is, okay, since that's a natural state of the system, what the system has to exhibit, this adiabatic temperature gradient, well, then where is the average going to be? The average can't be at the warmest part because that's not the definition of an average. The definition of an average is that it's around the middle, right? So then you say, okay, well, if it's supposed to be minus 18 degrees and that's supposed to be the average temperature, then you have to look at the average of the system. The average of the system isn't the hottest part of the system. It's the average of the system. So if you go to 5 to 6 kilometers altitude in the atmosphere, you actually find minus 18 degrees Celsius there. And that is about the average of the atmosphere. Then you apply the equation for the adiabatic gradient and you perfectly predict what the near surface air temperature of plus 15 degrees should be. So there's no real discrepancy actually between, the average solar flux the average energy emitted by the Earth of minus 18 degrees and the near surface air being warmer than that, because the near surface air shouldn't be that average. It's supposed to be warmer than the average due to the adiabatic gradient. And so, in fact, if you just look at that, that completely writes out needing to appeal to the greenhouse effect straight away right there.
Okay.
You can also add to that the fact that if you apply it to other planets, the same thing applies there, doesn't it? It's consistent throughout the whole solar system.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Venus, Jupiter, people have, I'm not sure, some people have done really good work on that, basically showing that at similar pressures in the atmosphere, Jupiter has the same temperature as Earth does, and Venus has the same temperature as Earth does when you look at identical pressures, at the altitude of identical pressure as Earth's, average near surface pressure, that is, yeah.
It's a compelling argument. It's a compelling argument to saying that adiabatic pressure is a key driver, a key determinant of the temperature rather than CO2, which is 0.04% of the atmosphere. So it's the idea that CO2 is the climate control knob is very, very spurious. Joe Olson, do you want to jump in on that one?
I am shocked that you actually managed to get a warmest and a lukewarmest to debate each other. Or at least to debate you so that you could get one of them out on the program. I saw the only known debate between a warmest and a lukewarmest, and that was Dr. Lindzen, Richard Lindzen from MIT, against Jerry North from Texas A&M at the Houston Petroleum Club in January of 2010, right after ClimateGate broke. And I also saw them again that night at Rice University And there's a whole bunch that both of them are missing. And just to get back to the, I want to do a more in-depth with you when we can do graphics so we can actually explain this stuff. The radiation physics is kind of complicated, but latent heat of vaporization and solidification is what brings water vapor cooling the Earth's surface up to clouds where it condenses. And then the clouds add to the albedo and they reflect sunlight. So that's a cooling effect. And then they also evaporate off the lower by lapse rate, 4 degrees per 1,000 foot Fahrenheit or 3 degrees centigrade for every 1,000 foot. And so that means the top of the cloud is automatically colder than the bottom of the cloud. The bottom of the cloud is evaporating based on the amount of heat coming off of the Earth and the amount of sunshine that it's absorbing. And the average thunderstorm is 20 miles in diameter, weighs 16,000 tons, has 10 to the 15 joules of energy. And at any given moment, there's 1,800 thunderstorms on the surface of the Earth. If you look at a satellite photos, the equator of the Earth is just one stream of thunderstorms side by side all the way across the equator. So when was the last time, and like I said, it absorbs in 37,000 spectral lines. When was the last time a cloud got between you and the sun and you felt hotter? When was the last time a cloud dumped hot rain, hot sleet, hot hail, and hot snow on you? It just doesn't happen. So if you knock out that water vapor is a cooling gas, then that means that you have no other warming gases of any measurable amount.
What we argue at Principia Scientific is the fact that the water cycle effectively is the Earth's thermostat, because it moderates, doesn't it? It moderates. Because we look at the extremes of the moon. Joe Posma pointed out the extreme temperatures between hot and cold at the moon. And what we have on Earth is the moderating effect, where 70% of the planet is covered by water. It's the water cycle itself that prevents the extremes of temperature, isn't it, gentlemen?
Yeah, absolutely. It's as huge as Joel Olson referenced. It's the huge thermal capacity of water, and not just in its usual phases, but then you have these latent phases. Latent phases are amazing. Latent energy is the most mind-boggling thermodynamic process you can imagine, because you have, in that case, sunlight coming down, which is 120 degrees Celsius if it was to hit a black surface, but water absorbs it. And the thing about a latent heat phase is it absorbs thermal energy without rising in temperature. So that's amazing. Correct. Because most substances don't do that. And then that's water does that in two spots, you know, changing from ice to liquid, you know, H2O, from ice to liquid, and then also from a liquid to vapor. And those latent energy regions are huge sinks of energy. They absorb a massive amount of energy. Those are huge moderators.
Yes, latent heat of vaporization for water is 2,260 kilojoules per kilogram. That's a lot of energy. And then it doesn't create energy. What it does is it takes that from the heated surface up to a point where it is lower altitude, higher altitude, which means lower pressure and lower temperature, where it condenses and it releases that 2,260. And if it goes up high enough, it can do the latent heat of solidification, which is where it turns to hail, sleet, and snow. And that's an additional 334 kilojoules per kilogram. So you're talking an enormous heat transfer that keeps the planet cool. And water vapor molecules outnumber carbon dioxide by about 2,000 to 1 in the lowest humidity locations on Earth, which is the Alkama Desert down in Chile and down at Antarctica. But other than that, it's usually 4 or 5 times greater than that. So when they get a relative humidity of 100% because it's overcast and it's raining, it's actually only about 4% of the atmosphere, because there's still 79% nitrogen and 20% oxygen. So, but bottom line is, that we do not have there is no greenhouse warming gas at all. None of them are. And this is part of the fraud so they can push the green energy thing, so they could get us, quote, off of fossil fuels, and which is an additional fraud. But we've got the biggest fraud now, and that's the Wu flu jab scam, which is, you know, what we talked about in our first hour. So we're discussing the biggest frauds in science simultaneously on the same program tonight.
All right. Well, point, Joe. We're going to have to take a break now. This is TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather
with reality and perspective.
Well, good day, all you lovers of good weather. I decide to be cheerful this evening. Well, if you are listening on the other side of the world today, I like a quote from a few prominent Democrats. I used to be a Democrat way back when there was a guy named H.L. Mencken. And Mencken had some very interesting things to say. For instance, the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the populace alarmed and hence clamorous to be led to safety by an endless series of hobgoblins, most of them imaginary. And he said this, the urge to save humanity is almost always a false front for the urge to rule it. Now, let me ask the intelligent TNT listener, where can we find examples of that today? How about in a phony climate war that is meant to get us all upset, all of us scared about everything, over what? Well, if you're scared, you want to be led to safety, guess who benefits? This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Who is Klaus Schwab and what is the World Economic Forum which he leads? Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, believes transhumanization is a fundamental part of the Great Reset within the Fourth Industrial Revolution. He states, the difference of this Fourth Industrial Revolution is it doesn't change what you are doing. It changes you if you take genetic editing just as an example. It's you who are changed, and of course this has a big impact on your identity.
Democracy is under attack. The Australian government wants to control free speech and the internet with the Australian Code of Practice on Disinformation and Misinformation. Disagree with what government is saying and you'll be shut down and could face severe penalties. To find out more, go to digi.org.au. Lighting the fuse for freedom. This is TNT Radio.
Hi, welcome back. On the show today, we have Tom Nelson, a climate skeptic like us, kindred spirit, and we're talking about the greenhouse effect and looking at your blog, Tom, tomnelson.blogspot.com. Tell us a bit about your blog. I mean, do you do much work on that? Is it something you actively do yourself, or do you have help, or give our listeners an idea?
Yeah, it's not very active anymore. I have pretty much switched over to Twitter, but it's where I did all my work for many years. But the last, 7 years or something, I've been almost 100% on Twitter instead. But I do have one post at the very top there that has notes for climate skeptics. So I try to put stuff about, try to cover kind of everything. What are the polar bears doing, hurricanes, all sorts of stuff. But Twitter is where I do my work these days and on my podcast.
Let's give a shout out to your Twitter account then.
Yeah, it's just tan123, like the color tan on Twitter.
Yeah. Oh, that simple, really. Okay. So do you find the presentation that Joe Olson, Joe Possum are giving that, is it kind of an illustration of the climate scenario that you jibe with? Do you find that many people get into the debate talking about the water cycle and about the effects of latent heat? Or is that a bit alien to the conversations that you have with people in the climate debate?
That is a bit alien for me. Most of my stuff is at a higher level about just are hurricanes getting worse and what are crop yields doing and all that stuff. So I have not been involved in debating the greenhouse effect myself at all, pretty much.
No. Yeah, you're quite right. You can argue it on a multiplicity of levels. And it's
yes.
Your approach, I think, probably relates most easily to those who are lay people who don't actually have a scientific training. And we've got to reach those people, haven't we? It's an important thing that these are the voters. The masses are the people who vote in these corrupt politicians. And if we can't get them on our side, we're pretty much screwed, aren't we? What's your take on the so-called green energy?
I've had quite a few people on my podcast talking about the details of that. So I have learned a lot about it in the last couple of months. But my take is that we should just let the market figure it out. And I think Warren Buffett said that no one would put up wind farms if they weren't subsidized because it doesn't make sense. So I think almost all of the wind turbines and solar panels that are put up around the world are put up because of subsidies, and they don't make sense if you don't have the subsidies. And I do think that fossil fuels are, because of their energy density, are just a way better solution. They're so much more reliable and I am a nuclear power fan as well. I think at some point whenever we do run out of fossil fuel, we're going to have to go with nuclear. And that's another good solution. It's a good, safe solution as well.
Yeah. And what about electric vehicles? Do you think that they're a good idea, or do you think that's just a complete scam altogether?
I would lean towards the scam side myself. I think they certainly can work if you do a lot of short trips and you never want to go on a longer trip. But for a family that is just going to have one car and they occasionally want to take a long trip, I think the EV does not make much sense. And then a few people on my podcast have pointed out that they take so many rare earth minerals to make up those batteries. I think someone said that if they were just to convert all of the vehicles in the UK to EVs, that would take up twice the cobalt that's mined every year in the entire world. So there's a big problem with sourcing the parts or the minerals that you need to run on EVs, and it just doesn't make sense overall, because the whole idea is supposed to be that you're going to try to prevent bad weather. That's the whole idea, going to get less hurricanes, blah, blah, blah. And it's not going to have any measurable beneficial effect on the weather or climate. So I would say let's not do it.
Well, yeah, and it is quite toxic. And, you know, as we were discussing earlier, I think, you know, it's been totally... Well, CO2 is being called pollution when, in fact, burning these hydrocarbon fuels. And, you know, we're doing it very cleanly now in modern vehicles. They're releasing basically just carbon dioxide and water vapor. That's the best thing you could do for the Earth, is actually returning this this carbon dioxide that's been sequestered away through the ravages of geologic and paleological history, giving it back to the atmosphere where it can be life again. It can go back into creating life.
Yeah, I totally agree that CO2 is our friend and warmth is our friend. They're both beneficial for us.
And surprisingly enough, Michael Moore, who's the flaming left-wing award-winning 17 different documentary film producers, produced a film called Planet of the Humans, where he gives you 90 minutes of evidence about every one of the green energy scams. It's absolutely outrageous. He was vilified by the left when he put it out, but he said, I'm sorry, but we're being scammed by the same people that own the oil industries and the same banking industries, and this is a horrible non-solution. It's absolutely great. I recommend it. Planet of the Humans.
Yeah, I saw it too. I love that film. I was very impressed by that work of his.
I was sickened by it. I was just sickened when it got to the point. No, I mean in a good way, when it got to the point that it's showing that this green energy stuff just means, you know, they call it wood chips. What does that mean? It means that they're really just burning down forests. They're cutting down forests. It just made me feel sick. It was horrific. It was horrific. They're cutting down forests for green energy.
Biofuels.
Talk about a green environmental policy.
Yeah, 1/3 of our cropland goes into producing ethanol for gasoline, which reduces your gas mileage and ruins your engine. Diesel fuel takes twice as much energy to produce as you get out of the diesel fuel by making it from soybeans. The whole thing is absolutely loony.
Yeah, I agree with you. And not only is it loony, but I think that the truth is they actually know, the powers that be actually know the night data. They do know the facts. They do know that these so-called green energy boondoggles, they don't make the planet greener, the planet cleaner. It's clearly all about control, isn't it? The point, Tom, that to power the UK with electric vehicles would take twice the available cobalt. It's an indication they don't want us all to have electric cars. They just want to reduce the number of vehicles available anyway. So it's not for the masses. Basically, it's about depopulation. Do you agree?
I do agree that I've heard quite a few people argue that EVs are just a stepping stone to getting rid of private transportation entirely or getting more control over us. And I do agree that may be a plan, that once we're driving EVs we could have central bank digital currency and all this other stuff where they could easily control how many miles we're driving. And I think they really want to get rid of private vehicles and force us all onto public transport in the future, I wouldn't doubt.
Yeah, you're probably aware of Klaus Schwab's statement that you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And it's the Great Reset. The narrative is scary, isn't it? It's beyond 1984, beyond even George Orwell's concept of dystopia.
I think we need to fight this with every fiber of our being, I think.
Mm.
Tom, I wanted to ask you then, Tom, what are your plans for the future?
I don't have any real big plans myself. I do plan to just heavily focus on my podcast because I'm having such a great time with that. So as long as I can, I'm going to just keep fighting this insanity. And I really do enjoy it, and I think it's the right thing to do. So I'm going to keep fighting.
Sorry, Joel, and I think I cut you off. Yeah.
Yeah, as a trend, the UK is required as of July of this year, all home charging stations for EVs are required to have a smart meter so that they can back uncharge your Tesla overnight if the grid is low. So bottom line is they're going to use your battery as part of the underserved electrical system. And the problem is with electric vehicles, you have a certain number of dendrites that are chemicals that form during the course of charging and uncharging due to the certain amount of impurities that are impossible to get out of batteries. And so you're limited to about a 400 charge and discharge cycle for all batteries. And so bottom line is the UK is going to use your electric car to power the country when it's not working. And you can bet they're going to want to do the same thing in the United States. Plus, they're easily trackable and they're easily controllable through the 5G network. So it is nothing to do with the environment. It's everything to do with being able to control your ability to travel and have free assembly and free speech.
I have a couple other points to make on EVs. Somebody was saying, and I agree, just think about in Florida, if a hurricane is coming and everybody has only EVs and they're all trying to flee at the same time, what sort of mess that could be if not everybody's vehicle is charged and these vehicles become bricks if they run out of charge on the highway. I think that could really cause problems in a situation where people have to leave quickly. And then another thing was Thomas Massey, who is a congressman, was talking about how much extra grid power it would take to charge all these EVs. He was saying that if the average household in the U.S., if they were to have two EVs instead of gas-powered vehicles, that it would take the equivalent of them plugging in 25 additional fridges in their house. So because that's how much it would take to charge two EVs. So do we have enough charging capacity, if everybody plugs in 25 refrigerators in their household? So again, people haven't really thought it through, this whole idea, hey, let's just charge up our vehicles instead of using fossil fuel. They haven't run the math on it.
No, good point. I mean, you made a point earlier that the fact that hydrocarbons are far more efficient means of, the concept of a battery, if you take the concept of stored energy, the hydrocarbon fuel is the most ideal solution we have, isn't it? Because it really is nature's answer. You know, it truly is the way forward, because we've pointed out before on Principia Scientific that just to construct these vehicles, we're outsourcing our energy needs and our strategic resources to foreign nations. And lithium is mined in Outer Mongolia. We know that the current political situation is not conducive to energy availability. We know in Ukraine the war is raging, and the fact in the EU they're talking about a 5-10% reduction in energy use during the winter. And when you reduce the energy consumption during a severe European winter, people die.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. I wanted to ask Tom. Yeah, that's such a good point, John, for sure. I want to ask Tom one question. Do you think that this rise in CO2 is even coming from human use of hydrocarbons? Because, you know, when you take the example of the lockdowns, when the shutdown in transportation use of hydrocarbon fuels, there's no change in the Keeling curve. It seems that the rise in CO2 isn't actually even being driven by human.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I do not know the answer to that. I don't know what percent of the rise is caused by humans. Great question, though.
Yeah, the Keeling curve itself is very, very spurious because it's situated right by an active volcano, isn't it? I mean, if you want to rig the game, why not do it that way? And it's just a mockery of science, isn't it?
I think it is, yeah. I would like to make one more point about energy density, that fossil fuels have such a great advantage in energy density that somebody ran the numbers, and that if you were to try to power a large jet airliner using a battery, using current batteries, it would take a battery that weighs 3.5 million pounds. There's just no way you could get it off the ground. So that's a very important point.
It is.
Yeah.
It's unicorns and rainbows are going to make them fly. It's ridiculous.
And yeah. And it's liquid. There's a convenience in liquid too. Liquid is just so easy to transport. Liquid fuels are really the best. High density energy liquid fuels. You can't beat them. There's no substitute for that.
Yeah, yeah. See, this is what happens when you get four people who are devoted to applied science. You know, we come together with a modicum of common sense and the idea that, as Joe Posner said, you can look at a few graphs, you can crunch the numbers, and you can see very quickly where the fraud is. And we've been lied to for so many years now. And, 30 plus years, we've been lied to about green energy and CO2 and the greenhouse effect. And I think its days are very much numbered, just like the vaccine scare story. So, Tom Nelson, you know, it's a wonderful opportunity to have you on the show and talk about these things. And we wish you well, and long may it continue. And, let's get a few more people on your podcast and debate you, because it's great entertainment, gentlemen, isn't it? We really love watching your videos.
I'm glad to hear it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Tom Nelson. It's the Sky Dragon Slaying. We'll look forward to seeing you again in our next episode.